You are listening to Fruitless, a podcast hosted by me, Josiah Sutton. This is episode 6, Painting the East, featuring Jackal. Welcome, everyone, to Fruitless. I am joined today, of course, by my co-host of Mammonburg, Jackal. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself super quick?
Hi, everybody. I'm Jackal from Mammonburg fame, infamy. You tell me. And also, I've been known to creep around like Christian Twitter and other parts of Twitter.
Yep. And a guest on Odd Splice with Josh, our
yes,
first,
I was
first
also,
guest
I talked,
on this.
I talked slashers with him, and I had like a really, really good time. I also, there was a slightly off topic, there was a post going around on horror Twitter of this just trying to sum up like different horror genres, like completely threw the slasher genre under the bus, and then like I made like, hey, shut the fuck up.
Slashers are good. Yeah, no, you got me slashers wanting to watch good, slashers actually. When I listen to that. So
hell yeah, it worked. Because the point was, I was trying to like get people like, oh, what? Hey, yes, slashers are dumb by nature. They kind of are kind of basic, but they do have
they
something
do
more
something.
To them, in
yeah.
my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do something. Even the bad stuff, like, the bad stuff is entertaining schlock, but the good stuff makes you think and is actually trying to talk about stuff as themes and shit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so Jackal here is an artsy guy, but that doesn't come up a ton on Mammonburg, which is a shame.
Not really.
Shame. So I've decided to drag him on to talk about that. We were floating a bunch of options, and one of the options that he suggested was talking about Orientalism, which is something that I know very little. So, I know very little about Orientalism in at all, and I know even less about it when it's talking about art theory. So I think it would be kind of fun to get into this and kind of get like a crash course to Orientalism and art. So, hell yeah.
Great. Okay, so I guess I'll start this off with asking, what do you know about Orientalism? Like, just what does the word kind of spring to your mind before I get to, like, talking about it?
My general working understanding is that it's about Western conceptions of, you know, stuff in the of the Orient, quotations marks around that. You know, like, thinking about, like, the Middle East or Asia or something like that. And emphasizing the differences rather than the similarities, and kind of making caricatures of, you know, of this different land over there in Asia or whatever. That's kind of what my understanding of what it means is.
That is actually pretty spot on for broadly what Orientalism is.
I didn't have to read that essay.
You didn't even have to read that essay. Though you should. It's a good essay. So before we get to, I guess, get to like talking art theory and analyzing some paintings, which we will do. We have some works that Josiah, I'm assuming he'll put them in the show notes so you can look at them
absolutely
along the way as so you can look at them as we talk about them. But I'll give a brief sort of rundown on like the terminology of Orientalism. So Orientalism refers, it comes from the word, you know, the Orient, which is in reference to the Occident, the East and West. So this is, you vote like this divide between like what is East and what is West. And so the Orient was in reference to countries outside like the Mediterranean and like maybe Southern Europe, kind of, but not some parts of Southern Europe. But it would mostly refer to like North Africa, West Asia / the Middle East, and then even stuff that's further out from like the Orient of like the Mediterranean into like Central and East Asia, which is not near the Mediterranean as you know.
Right.
And also India too, the Indian subcontinent, which is again not near the Mediterranean. So this term kind of There's two parts I could refer to. One is that there's Oriental studies, which is like in the 18th, 19th centuries, consequently, you know, the rise of Western empires, specifically the French Empire, which we're going to talk a lot about the French Empire here and French artists in particular. So originally, like, Orientalism and or an Orientalist, like, referred to, and technically still does, like, Oriental studies is still a thing, though I'm sure that most are not quite comfortable using that term anymore.
Right.
It's, like, this is where the academic field of, like, studies of, like, Near Eastern and Far Eastern societies had developed in Europe. This was sort of allowed by the... certainly, like, the beginnings of it came from the East India Company setting up across the world, and then France setting up its various colonies, and Napoleon invading Egypt. Then you had, so this entrance of, like, books and knowledge from the quote-unquote Orient had built this field of Orientalism up to study these cultures. There's a particular phrenologist, probably was both, maybe. William Jones, he studied Indo-European languages. He was, like, the person who established, like, the modern study of languages. He's also an Orientalist because he was studying languages from the Orient, like Arabic, and this is also where he had, like, the rise of Hebraism. I'm not going to say that right, but, like, Jewish studies of, like, of, like, Jewish culture. So stuff that was relating to studies of the Near East and also archaeology was really starting to come up around that time. So that's what it originally, like, was centered around. Was this idea of, like, this academic discipline that studied the Near and Far East. Now, if you jump to from the 18th and 20th and 19th century, let's jump to the 20th century, you've got he was a Palestinian American, Edward Said. He was a cultural critic. He redefined the term Orientalism, which at that point had still meant, like, the academic study of the quote-unquote Orient and the Far East.
Yeah.
He had used it to redefine Orientalism to mean something else that he was seeing within the academic and just sort of, like, general sort of, like, milieu of the Western tradition. Which was that he saw, like, academic and artistic, and we'll get to art in a moment of how this relates to that, was that there was this prejudiced outsider interpretation of the Eastern world or the Orient. It was shaped by cultural attitudes of European imperialism emerging in the 18th and 19th century. This is where we have, like, the rise of the colonial empires that would basically define, like, the modern world that we have now. This is where you saw that rise. So this essay, there's an essay that is particularly famous in the academic tradition now, Orientalism, that he wrote, which I will encourage anyone listening to this episode to go and read. It was influenced by, like Gramsci, Foucault, critical theory of, you know, the scary critical theory.
We got to get that out of the schools.
We need to get, you know what we need? Just we need to get back some Orientalist understanding. I think we were better off when we were, like, when we thought that, like, the East was filled with, like, it was
a magical
mystical place. Was this magical place where there were flag carpets and strange bearded men smoking from a hookah.
Yeah, I'm just going to start showing Aladdin in my in a world history course. No, but yeah. So it's a critical theory kind of approach to this question, right?
Yeah, of analyzing, like, this thing that he saw, which as a Palestinian American, was aware of how the West was viewing the East. So Said, like, criticized, like, contemporary scholars who kept perpetuating this, like, this idea of, like, this outsider interpretation. This is a big thing that you see in Orientalism, is that it's of the outsider looking at it. It's not even like going to these people and seeing what they believe or asking. Like, it's not doing that. It's just looking from the outside with and looking at misconceptions and already built in societal stereotypes and just going with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like he saw this a lot, like contemporary academic studies in the 70s, which, you know, no surprise. It should be said also, I think at this time you had like the I believe it was either being written or being published was the People's History of the United States.
Yeah. So yeah, I can speak to this in regards to history anyway. The 60s and 70s is when you start to see kind of this critical shift in a lot of history and academia, because it is the influence of Marxism as much as I think people overemphasize that. You know, there starts to be this emphasis on doing history from below, you know, looking at identity groups, stuff like that. That eventually then starts to get the influence of literary theory and post-structuralist stuff around the late 70s and 80s. Foucault shows up, all that good stuff. That's kind of the context Said's writing in.
This is happening a lot at that time. So Said is like not the only one. However, a lot of he's a part of this trend that kind of changes academia, both like anthropology, cultural criticism, history, and, you know, broadly like theology, religious, like all these academic fields at the time are being upended by like more just like open discussions of and trying to change like the status quo centered around them.
Absolutely.
So Said talked about like that. It's there's a quote here that I'll read. It's from, you can also, if you go to like the Wikipedia page, you'll find it too. The idea of representation is that of a theatrical one. The Orient is the stage on which the whole East is confined.
Hmm.
It is not so much, the Orientalist is not analyzing so much the East itself as the East made known, and therefore less fearsome to the Western reading public. It's not analyzing what the East actually is on like a human level. It's engaging with it as this theatrical thing and not actual people.
Yeah, and it kind of seems to kind of be more like the East as more of a Rorschach thing, where it's saying more about what the Westerner is writing about it than it does about the actual people in the East. You know, it's more a look into Western ideas about the other.
Now, there's some criticism that I'll say that comes from Said of like how he doesn't engage with like Orientalist art in regards to this, and that it can't, like, there's an art historian, Linda Nicolin, who sort of disagreed with Said's points broadly. But I think that this is like this book, this essay becomes this foundational text for like critical studies in relation to cultural criticism and also post-colonial studies as well. But the criticism is that he's analyzing like literature and academia, but not art. I would say yes, but you can also find art is a form of expression like literature. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the same because it's a different form of expressing that, of expression and media. However, there's some commonalities that you can see that is in both like Orientalist literature and Orientalist art. They're both doing the same thing of basically setting up the quote unquote East as this theatrical, mythical place and not engaging on it from a human level.
Okay. Yeah.
So, that being said, also, I'll say, broadly, Orientalism also relates to architecture, where you have, like, there's certain, like, architectural trends that came to Europe of, like, there's the Royal Pavilion in Brighton, England. There's also, like, Chinese-style sort of pottery that catches on, particularly with, I think it was when, like, Rococo, which is another art movement that dying down, that became particularly popular, perpetuated by the Dutch East India and the Dutch East India and the British East India companies, which, to keep in mind, all this is happening because there's like brutal colonial wars going on for resources. That's how going on in the background for all of this set in the 18th and 19th century.
Okay. Yeah.
So Orientalism also can apply to like It can also apply to some parts of fashion, and it also will apply to architecture. Mm-hmm. Like you'll see if you look at it, there are some like in Germany and in Switzerland, France, even Crimea, Russia, and in England, there's architecture that is designed to look like architecture that you would find in the quote unquote Orient in North Africa, mm-hmm. and particularly like North Africa, Egypt, and the Ottoman Empire, which was stretching like across gotcha. The Middle
yeah.
East.
Interesting. So okay.
It was,
yeah, yeah.
It was like this fascination of the East.
Yeah.
So with that being said, on to the actual like art of Orientalism.
So this is going to often be European art depicting.
Yes. Talking about Orientalist, I am almost exclusively referring to.
Takes a long time. The odor of all prison food takes a long time to pass you by. Day upon day of this wandering gets you done. Nobody gives you a chance or a dollar.
When I say West Asia, I'm also referring to the Middle East, but that just okay. Keep that in mind.
So let's take a look at some paintings.
Let's look at some paintings. So I sent you, how many paintings have I sent you? I kind of lost track.
Five, if we're not including that one that's, I don't think that the other one was supposed to be part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, there are, I sent you five paintings. So we'll go down in like order of like numerical order that I sent them.
So we'll
the first
start with
one,
this one.
Here is Napoleon in the plague, in the plague house at Jaffa. Okay, so this is also coming from, I found a very good article discussing some of this stuff from the Met, so I'll be pulling from that as well. So something that you can probably see we'll continue with what we did with like when we were doing Very Legal, Very Cool from that episode, yeah. Where I'll ask you to describe what you see in the painting, I'm curious to see like how do you see it? So what do you see when you look at this painting?
So we see some French troops in, I'll say the first thing that sticks out to me oddly is the architecture around it, which I think that's a pretty good kind of Orientalist emphasis here. Cause you've got like those, I don't know what that's called, but the kind of striped looking entrance on the far left there.
It's been a year since I've done my Islamic art class. So there is a term for that, but I don't remember at the moment.
And then, it's within this structure here, we have these French troops and they're talking to these kind of naked, struggling people who look like they're sick. Based off the name, I assume they're sick. Name of the piece. And then the kind of helpers or whoever, the people who aren't sick, they're kind of like wearing like, some sort of turbans and stuff like that, or head coverings. And they're kind of like walking around, and there's a really distinct, just naked, sick looking guy looking terrified at the French soldiers. That's kind of the stuff that sticks out to me immediately.
Right. So that is the central French soldier that we see there. That's Napoleon.
Okay, yeah, that's what
this is set during Napoleon's failed excursion into Egypt.
Gotcha. Okay.
So something that we'll see common in all Orientalist paintings is that there's this emphasis on the Orient and the East as this place of barbarousness, lawlessness, like backwardness. This like mm-hmm. this place of like. Of like moral depravity and decay that is going to be enlightened and uplifted by Europe. It's either like a genre painting, which a genre painting is basically a depiction of like life, just sort of like casual life. Mm-hmm. You'll see there's a lot of genre paintings of the of life in this Orientalist view. However, all of these are basically pushing and are either subtly or overtly, like in this one, are pushing this idea of like this backwardness and barbarity of the Orient. It is this barbaric, violent, sad, sick, mythical, yada yada place that is going to be uplifted and brought to civilization by these enlightened empires.
Yeah, this is really, I mean, once you say that, I can definitely see that's going on in this painting, because you have this like heroic, you know, Napoleon looks pretty heroic in it. You've got these like put together, nice looking, you know, French Republican kind of soldiers. And they're coming in to help out here with this, like the throng of sick people here, you know, savage people, right?
Because this was set during a plague afflicted, these are plague afflicted. Afflicted prisoners during the siege of Jaffa, which I think Napoleon lost, if I remember correctly.
I don't know if he did or not. I think he did.
I think he did. The Egyptian expedition for France and Napoleon did not go very well.
Did not go well, but that was also his claim to fame, right?
It was, because it didn't go well for France, but it also, and this painting is an example of it, it was a great propaganda win for Napoleon.
Yeah, well, and that's I believe there's still stolen artifacts from this expedition.
There are,
like,
yes.
In France, yeah, because if you go to Paris, there is an obelisk in Paris that's actually, it's kind of really weird. It's at the spot where the guillotine was during the revolution. It's the Place de la Revolution. It's, which is, I don't know, really odd, because it's like, okay, it's a stolen artifact, and it's also, you're just kind of like standing at a place, you know, with so much bloodshed happened there. It's really,
well, if you go to Europe, you'll be hard pressed to go to a part of Europe that was not filled with bloodshed.
That's true. But for some reason I could feel this like weight when I think, because the French Revolution was like the first historical subject I really read a lot about. So it was like, oh, this is like where it all happened.
Whoa. Like, I feel the weight of history here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. And also, so to further clarify, so this is set at the Armenian Saint Nicholas Monastery in Egypt, or the Saint Nicholas Monastery Jaffa.
So it's not Muslim.
No, but
you get that vibe from it, don't you?
you would think that it is from how this is depicted, but it's not because. This may come as news to, hopefully not news to people who listen to the show, but there are Christians in Egypt. There are the Copts, the Coptic Christians are one of the oldest Christian ethnic groups that exist. They're up there with Ethiopia for like history and longevity. I believe the Coptic language is also a descendant of ancient Egyptian as well. So you would not think that would be the case from how this painting depicts it. And also, those soldiers are not, Egyptians. Those are his own, those are French soldiers, that Napoleon is coming to visit them, during the siege of Jaffa.
Okay. The sick looking soldiers, you mean?
Those naked figures. And if you look, Napoleon is like touching them, like he's touching them and comforting them and invoking sort of symbolism, like Christian imagery of like the divine touch of kings, of like the healing touch that Jesus has.
Yeah, which that does track. I was kind of wondering about that because they were more white, and I felt like they would, if they weren't, if they were supposed to be like Coptic or, you know, Egyptians, they would probably get depicted in more of a emphasizing darker skin and stuff, but. So then, but more like the throng of sick people, is that supposed to in general be, is that all French soldiers, or?
I think if you look at the skin composition wise, most are, there are a few other darker skinned people there, but most are lighter skinned.
Yeah. So then the guy on the far left there with in the robe, I assume he's supposed to more represent like an Egyptian kind
healer,
of figure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay.
So yeah, that's what you see here is, it's basically like, this is, I don't think it's really much of a jump to say this is like a propaganda piece for Napoleon.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was in fact commissioned by Napoleon.
That tracks.
In 1804, depicting a scene that supposedly happened in 1799.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So this was basically an attempt to the history behind, so we're now going to get kind of dark with some of this. Like, the background behind this one specifically is that this was an attempt to, one, this was to embroider and bolster his legend. Like Napoleon's legend, his mythology, his legacy as like this heroic general that would help his soldiers, like a father to his men kind of general.
Yeah.
Oh, well, and also to further bolster. Yeah. And to further bolster like the mythology surrounding his expedition into Egypt.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What this was also done was an effort to quell reports that Napoleon ordered 50 plague victims at Jaffa to be given fatal doses of opium in his retreat.
I did not know that.
It was also done to counter reports that French war crimes committed during the capture of Jaffa.
Yeah, how could there be war crimes? Look at how gentle he is in this picture.
Look at how gentle. Look at how calm, how benevolent he is.
Yeah. He's working alongside the Egyptian healer there, you know? He's
he sent a trumpeter to Ahmed al-Jazar, who was a governor, the Ottoman governor at that time. Basically ordered him to surrender. Ahmed decapitated the messenger and ordered a sortie. The sortie was pushed back to the early evening, like that same day. The French destroyed one of the towers of the city's fortifications. But like this was a long bloody siege. He did allow local citizens to like leave the city, so it would carry it would carry news that like, yeah, we captured the city of Jaffa. We did it.
Yeah.
This ignores that it would appear that he killed over sources are mixed. At the least, he killed 2,440 prisoners of war.
Jesus.
At the high estimates are 4,100 prisoners of war. Most of them Albanians. They were shot or stabbed.
Following the tradition of the that old Very Legal, Very Cool episode we did about art history, re-emphasizing that Napoleon was a monster.
He was a horrible person.
So much PR has been done to make him not like automatically a monster in people's eyes. He one of the most vile human beings ever, truly.
This all comes from this was a promise that he made to his stepson, Eugene de Beharnais. I'm not going to get this name right at all. Yeah, I do not speak French. he executed the Ottoman governor. He allowed his soldiers 2 days to kill and rape at their leisure.
How nice of him! Yeah.
Do you see why this painting was made? Why he commissioned it?
Yeah, because it was an absolute shit show, like in how it actually played out. But it's so heroic looking in this kind of romanticist style here. Yeah,
this was the city of Jaffa was one of it would appear like from looking further into it, it was one of like the last cities that he was able to like get to before his Syria Egypt expedition completely shit the bed. I think at that point his navy wasn't quite sunk yet, but that it was sunk. It's funny that an opener that we've done for both Very Legal, Very Cool and now Fruitless is that Napoleon was a monster and he should be remembered as a monster.
He absolutely should be.
Both relating to these are both like art history topics, but broadly relate to the idea of Napoleon was one of the worst human beings that existed historically. Like objectively, he was a monster.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I mean, this is this podcast is all about rabbit trails. We'll go down a quick rabbit trail. You can see this reflected in literature that's not French literature a lot. So like, you ever gotten the chance to read Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky? Part of like the psychology of the murderer in that book is that he has convinced himself that he is a great man of history in the same way that Napoleon was. Right. And so like, yeah, there when you talk to Russians, I mean, read War and Peace, read like some Dostoevsky. they see him like a Hitler figure. You know, they saw him that way, which I think is a much more accurate way of seeing him.
And they're not wrong.
No, they're not.
It's not wrong.
But if you, but French people,
he's one of the greats. Well, actually, I don't know. Is Napoleon lauded in French literature?
Depends on who you're talking to. He's tricky. Because, I mean, he can't, you know, his lineage comes back after, in 1848. And
yeah.
I don't know. But, you know, your French leftists see Napoleon as a tragedy. You know, like, what's often forgotten is Napoleon or Marx's quote, you know, history repeats itself first as tragedy, then as farce. The tragedy is Napoleon. The farce is Napoleon III is what he's referring to in that quote.
Right.
They reinstated Napoleon. So. It's this, you know, it's this tragedy of every time we have a revolution, some dumbass Bonapartist ends up taking over.
I don't think I'm saying a hot take when I say that I think that Napoleon is probably responsible for more misery and suffering than Robespierre.
Yeah, no, actually, for sure. And when you talk about God, I knew this guy way back in the day who was really interested in Germanic languages, like lost Germanic languages. And they had like, there are languages that were lost in the Napoleonic Wars, like whole Germanic languages that do not exist, that existed before the wars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was genocides just throughout Europe. And then, you know, in that previous episode, you know, from a long time ago, we talked about Goya and Spain.
The Peninsular Wars,
yeah. Awful shit. Anyway, do we want to move on to the next painting here?
Yes. I think you got sort of, there's a trend that will come up that that Orientalist paintings are, and that's why I use this first one as a sort of like to set the tone for us talking about Orientalist art.
Mm-hmm.
Because on one hand, this is a beautiful painting. It's gorgeous.
Oh, it like, is, objectively, yeah.
It's an objectively gorgeous painting in terms of composition, lighting. The composition is compelling, and the composition is compelling, and it clearly tells a story. The figures are clear and have character to them, like each one. The colors are vivid yet muted, and the lighting is dramatic, but not quite bold. It's a beautiful, beautiful painting. It's also a piece of propaganda. Propagandism to assuage the concerns of like atrocities that Napoleon committed.
Yeah, yeah, and emphasizing again this figure of this benevolent colonizing European who kind of is going to come in and you know take care of his people and take care of this you know backwards Eastern you know place
in exotic dresses and milling about into like this ancient mythical land.
And so this moves into the next painting, which I'm already gathering is a painting about what happens when those civil white men are not there.
Yes, this is this is gonna be fun.
Yeah. Also, a beautiful painting, though. That's what's frustrating.
Objectively, a fucking like all these paintings, all of them are gorgeous. They're also so, so horribly problematic.
Send ya commiserations, but I don't need them now. 'Cause I can't do this alone.
So before I get to this one, I'll also say, fun fact about most of the people that we'll be talking about here, there's one key exception, which I think makes him both an Orientalist and also not. How many of these people do you think, let's take a random guess for that, do you think these people went to these places that they were painted? Like, do you think they visited?
No.
Do you think they took a trip there? Do you
no,
think
not
they,
at
like,
all. No.
You're, looks like you're winning the prize, buddy. our wonderful painter here for Napoleon in the Plague House of Jaffa by what's his name? Anton Jigros, I think you don't pronounce the S.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a pupil of another, like, well-known French artist, Jacques Louis David. who was also just a general. Like, there's a ton of paintings that he did for Napoleon, not just this. So a lot of these Europeans, including him, did not actually travel for these paintings to actually get an idea of like what this place, what these places looked like. They were relying on already published travelogues and officially sanctioned literature and stories about these places.
Yeah.
So Delacroix was particularly interested in Delacroix actually did travel. He did travel to the regions that he painted, which is not common for Orientalist painters. So he made at least like more than one journey to like the region to get some understanding of what he's going to be painting.
You can tell that Delacroix is a great guy because if you search Delacroix in Google, it suggests paintings, and then it suggests Delacroix Orientalism.
Delacroix did so many Orientalist paintings.
Yeah, he seems to be many. The textbook guy for this conversation here.
there's another textbook guy that I'll bring that example if we have time, but his painting is the cover of the essay for Orientalism Edward Said, The Snake Charmer. Delacroix's massacre at Chios, it's Greek. It's set during the Greek Wars for Independence, which was another sort of thing that was set in the mind of a lot of Western Europeans, was the sort of breaking up of the Ottoman Empire and Greece specifically, like, seeking independence.
Yeah, which, side note, is kind of, it's kind of interesting how there's this kind of Orientalism to, like, thinking about the Balkans and stuff like that, especially when you talk about, like, Greece, when you then think of the canon of, like, great Western civilizations, Greece usually gets lumped in, but then once you get Greece after the Romans, then it's a barbaric, you know, wasteland in the Western imagination. With, you know,
the swarthy Greeks, who are also the founders of Western civilization.
Very, very complicated.
So Eugène Delacroix is a romanticist, and if you remember anything about the romanticists, they really loved emotion.
Oh yeah,
they were big on like emotion and feeling, and like, and particularly like romanticist painters. We talked a little bit about this with the Goya episode, is that you're trying to invoke like very extreme emotions in what you're trying to depict.
Yeah,
and Delacroix did that here at the massacre at Chios. Chios, we'll just say that for the sake of argument. So Delacroix was fascinated by like images of war and destruction, like emotional extremes, brutality. That's something that you saw a lot in Orientalist paintings and depicting like the various sort of conflicts of the time, from the Crimea War to the Greek War, Wars of Independence, to like the conquest of Algeria by France. A lot of these painters were really captivated by these ideas of like romantic tragedy and brutality.
Mm-hmm.
Here as well. So just describe this one as well.
Let's see if I can do this. So I'm assuming this is after a battle, when who are depicted as guys in like, you know, turbans, one's riding a horse, the big mustache, and you have these kind of, vaguely ethnic, not Western looking guys. And then there's lots of women with them. So I'm assuming this is supposed to be the raping and pillaging kind of after a battle. That's kind of the vibe I get from this. Because you see a man naked and a woman looking sad near him. And it looks like this is a lot of these. Yeah, something like that.
Yes,
that's kind of the vibe I'm getting from it. Yeah,
this is set during the Chios massacre on the island of Chios, where thousands of Greeks were killed, like tens of thousands of Greeks were killed by the Ottomans during the war. So what happened with that was that during the war, other Greeks went to the island to try to encourage the residents of Chios to try to encourage them to join in the revolution for independence.
Mm-hmm.
this gained a response from the Ottomans, where they came to the island and killed thousands of people.
Right.
Now, we know that Greeks in the Ottoman Empire are Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that this was received by, like, by Western Europe?
Oh, yeah, that it was the desecration of Christians, right?
Yes, and this was among other things that were leading to, like, causes for support for Greece, which eventually would lead to, like, Greece becoming independent from the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. Which is, it's tricky when you talk about Orientalism or whatever, because obviously the Ottoman massacre of Greeks is an awful thing. Not to
Ottoman Empire is not a good guy in any situation. No. So there's no need to worry about, like, it is, you do have to table, like, on one hand, the Ottoman Empire is another empire. They're doing the same shit that France and England and the Dutch and the Belgian, like, that's what all of these empires are doing. So you need to also table it to understand that, but also the Ottoman Empire is being depicted in a particular way.
As a certain type of savage that is, because it looks like, it looks like they're emphasizing the whiteness of the Greeks in this, which is kind of interesting, because in other times at the same period, they would probably, you know, depict Greeks in a very
unflattering,
emphasizing their, you know, ethnic differences. Yeah, because the Balkans have always kind of had that Orientalism pointed at them. But yeah, but in this case, it's Christians. You know, Christians against the Muslims here.
Yes. So I'll quick thing on the battle. So they pillaged and looted the town April 12th of 1822. Orders were given to burn down the town, and over the next 4 months, an estimated 40,000 Turkish soldiers arrived. In addition to setting fires, the troops were ordered to kill all infants under the age of 3, all males 12 years and older, and all females 40 and older, except those willing to convert to Islam. The British warship, the HMS Seringapatam was on duty in the Mediterranean under the command of Captain Samuel Warren. This is where, like, they wanted to engage, but they were given orders to observe under strict neutrality in the Greek War of Independence, but so they didn't give any assistance, so they proceeded on their way. 3/4 of the population were killed, enslaved, or they died of disease. It's estimated that 2,000 people remained on the island after 21,000 managed to flee. 52,000 were enslaved, 52,000 were massacred. It should also know some of the sources here are not... take some of this with a grain of salt. The numbers are not quite exact, but it was a lot of people.
Yeah.
I would also say to keep this in mind, England was doing the exact same thing in India and in Africa.
Yeah. Yes.
These, all, like, every European power was doing the exact same thing, because that's what empires do.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because obviously it is bad. What's taking place here. But then, yeah, there's kind of this hypocritical intervention from the European side where they act like, I can't believe this is happening, while they're, you know, doing the same thing elsewhere.
So with that context, this is depicting that massacre. And it was painted relatively recently, in the context of the massacre by Delacroix, depicting the event that had occurred. This, like, created outrage, and the painting was also used to sort of, like, further emphasize that. I think even it's also it is a well-loved piece in Greece because of that, because of it's sort of like this commemoration of this massacre.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, there was it was at the Athens War Museum. But in 2009, it was withdrawn from the museum in good faith initiative for the approval of, like, Greek and Turkish relations. There were protests over that, and then it was put back on display.
Yeah, there's some complexity there, because I actually, like, it was earlier this year, I attended an Orthodox service with friend of the show, Francis, and the... the priest made a brief statement just commemorating that it was, I think, the anniversary of some important battle in the Greek War for Independence. And so he was quickly commemorating like that because a lot of the people in that church were Greek immigrants. And so there's like a quick like, yay, everyone really cares about this stuff. So it is really deep in like the Greek, even among like immigrants, Greek kind of psyche.
Like if, if you're not Greek, like the Greek War for Independence is not talked about a ton in terms of like in relation to the other massive like upendings of society and colonial wars and revolutions that were happening during that era. But it was a big deal, and it's still a big deal to a lot of Greeks.
It's a it definitely is a center point of Greek nationalism and stuff, so in both a good way and a bad way depending on the nationalist, but anyway,
so the painting has some it's reminiscent to me of some of the stuff that you would see in Dante's Inferno.
It's definitely some horrifying scenes of women not being treated well.
The man in the front, he's the first, like, that's a dead or die man in like the front of the piece. Shows to be emphasized that like in the composition of this, there's no heroic figure that you usually have in most of these depictions, like that serves as like a contrast between like the barbarity of war versus the heroicism. You don't have that. It's just suffering.
Yeah, that's true, because the closest thing to that is probably the guy on the horse, but he's looking down and he doesn't really look heroic either. The horse doesn't even look happy that he's on him.
He doesn't. No one in this painting is exactly happy to be there.
Yeah, man, it's just...
This was also inspired by The Wrath of Medusa by another painter, Theodore Gurkalt, which has it's a similar sort of like composition to it. Like the composition structure of them are sort of like very they're very like triangular. This is terminology minutia, but like that there's a clear like the way of how these figures are posed and how each are sort of like it's in like a rough triangular sort of compositional shape. Rectangles indicate, I believe if I remember correctly, if you're depicting them in like in a figure, they're kind of shape-wise they represent aggression. While squares represent something more like solidity. So this is on one hand, this is like depicting a real thing.
That was a tragedy. However, you start to see, this emphasis on the unruly, you know, Arab man who desecrates Christian women specifically.
And I chose this because it's complicated. Because on one hand, this is a real event that happened.
Yeah.
But also, you can see that it does fall into that similar trend of depicting the unruly, savage East. This is a common, even if it's something like, yes, this thing happened. But there's a clear, like, there's a motivation here that's not just about trying to depict that alone.
Yeah, well, it gives me a more mixed feelings than the other painting, for sure. Because aside from it just being beautiful, it is commemorating, a genuine tragedy. It makes me think, to kind of pull it to current context, it makes me think of some statements people make about Russians. In regards to the Ukrainian war, where it's like, oh, well, Russians have this backwards culture that causes them to do this stuff. And it's like, well, no, it is bad that this is happening, of course, and like it should be denounced and the victims should be commemorated and la-di-da-di-da. But also, like, this isn't like, I don't know, the Eastern savages, you know.
It's a part, but no, just it's their... If we look at the skull, if we measure the skull, you will see.
Yeah, you can see it, yeah.
You can see. Do you see it now? Look at the skull that I have right here. Do you see that bump?
That's the aggression bump. Yeah.
that indicates. Now, if I told you that this was the skull of an Easterner, of one of those Slavs. You would, you see, it's indicative of some fucking aggression, some other
some stupid thing. Which, not to derail this too much, but that's also just a really baffling thing when people say shit like that about Russia, because Ukraine is very similar, like in
ethnic and cultural
makeup. So I don't. It's like why are you getting racist at Slavs for invading Slavic
other Slavs? And it's not to say there isn't a history of racism towards Ukrainians. However, I don't think that you can counterbalance that with let's just be racist to the other Slavs.
Well, do you want to move on to the next painting, or is there
anything
else you want to say?
That you brought up Russia, because we're going to talk about a Russian painter now.
Oh, cool. Is that what the Solomon's Wall
one is? Solomon's Wall by Vasily Vereshchagin. We'll go with that. Again, I am pronouncing these names horribly, because I've actually never heard his name pronounced out loud by another human being before. I've only read them.
Mm-hmm.
So Vasily was a Russian artist. He was a soldier. He was a controversial man. He was a moral chronicler of the Russian military. He would join the military with like an easel and a gun, and to protest the aggressive advances made by Imperial Russia toward the east and south. He traveled a lot. He went to, unlike a lot of the other Orientalists, he went to places more than once. Not only did he go to these places, but he actually did travel there semi-frequently, or at least he tried to.
Okay, yeah.
He did travel for, like, recreation or entertainment, but he, like, spent almost all of his career painting war scenes. So that's something that we're missing here, because not all of it is Orientalist, but I do... We could do an episode about Vasily's life at some point, because I think he's interesting, and also about a particular painting that he did, which is called the Apotheosis of War. It's you probably have seen it before. It's this painting of like this desolate landscape with thousands upon thousands of skulls, sort of topped over with crows, sort of like
hovering around them. Yeah.
It's particularly famous painting because he was, despite being in the Russian military, he wasn't really a fan of the military.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's kind of a common thing with Russians.
He had pacifist subtext, and these paintings of these other figures that he did, they were painted with, and in my view, somewhat of an empathy to them. And I think that makes him an interesting sort of contrast with other painters, where he's depicting them in a very particular, like, where they're depicting these people in a very particular way. Vasily is not really, in my
opinion. This one stands out of all the ones you sent me, because this one is, it feels more like, yes, it's an outsider painting, people of another ethnicity, but it seems like he's more trying to, get it, I guess. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong there, but so it seems more empathetic.
Before we get to that, so Josiah, let me say that again. Josiah, what's in this painting? What do you see?
Yeah, so it is at, as the title says, it looks like it's at Solomon's Wall in Israel. You kind of see figures talking and praying, I believe, at the wall. People are kind of crowding up to the wall. You do see your... I'm assuming that I think this is supposed to be some Jewish, and you've got like the shawls and stuff like that. Yeah. So it is definitely really emphasizing like a kind of Middle Eastern, West Eastern like dress in this. But I mean, so it's, they're kind of crowded up to the wall. The wall takes up a lot of the space, so it's like the people are mostly in the bottom fourth of the painting. Right. And they're kind of resting and praying and stuff.
So a bit of background on this painting. It caused a bit of a controversy when it came out. Do you want to guess why?
Well, if I'm correct, this wall, the Wailing Wall or whatever, it is a kind of holy site for both Jews and Muslims.
Yes.
And it does appear to be showing them both praying at it, kind of side by side. Am I correct there? Or
you would think, but no, this is actually a biblical painting.
Oh, interesting.
So this is a painting, it's depicting a young Joseph. There's like Joseph and Jesus are there, but they're in the background. You don't really see them. And Jesus is evidently like depicted as kind of so in 1883, Vasily took a trip to Syria and Palestine, and he stood there for 2 years. He was captivated by Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
He painted religious figures. Like, he was particularly fascinated by like depictions of like Jesus and the Holy Family in Jerusalem. He painted religious figures in commonplace manner, like stripped of any glorification.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that was done here, is that there's no glorification. It's just like a genre painting that happens to be a biblical painting.
Yeah, which I'm inclined to, so maybe that's why I do like this painting a lot, actually.
It caused controversy. It was banned in Russia when it was after its release, quote unquote. It was banned in Russia. In Vienna, the Catholic clergy called it a heresy.
Really?
So in an interview with a Viennese priest, basically Vasily said, like, I'm an atheist. It's not a surprise that, like, people would think that this is a heresy, but I actually, he said, like, I think that Jesus is a historical character defined by evangelical biographies. He was smart, and he was smart and justice. I think that might be a bit, basically, like, saying that that he believes that Jesus was a moral, morally upright, the typical sort of like secular view of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That he was a morally righteous figure, and he was smart and justice in some of his assessments. Cardinals, bishops have nothing in common with his name. They patronize on it, when in fact they are heretics themselves. So, do you see why this became a little controversial?
Yeah, I could see it. I can see it. But what's again, what's the Orientalist angle of this, I guess, is what I was going to ask here.
I presented this as sort of an opposition to other paintings, because something that you see in Vasily's stuff is that he isn't explicitly depicting these people as exotic. He's just really depicting them as people.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you do see the differences of dress here. But yeah, it doesn't seem like fetishized almost, or like exaggerated in the way that some of these other paintings do.
There are some other paintings that he has that are, that one could argue are kind of a little closer to Orientalism, how some of it's depicted. But he depicts them in more like, it's not like the dresses are not exaggerated. They feel like things that actual people there wear, not like fucking Aladdin chic.
Right.
There's another painting that he did that is called like They Celebrate, where I'll send this to you. This is, consider this a bonus one. This is not like a main one that we're going to go into deep dive, but we'll use this sort of like as another example of like Orientalist paintings that Vasily did.
It's gorgeous painting though. It is
Vasily is one of my favorite artists of all time. It's gorgeous. Yeah.
Let's go ahead and bookmark in a few months, revisit and do an episode just on him, because I'm kind of a sucker for this already.
I think you're gonna like, there's so like it's hard to select just one because he did so many paintings in this style.
Yeah.
But this one's more
Orientalist, yeah, for sure. I do see it.
Is that I think that he brings a realism to these paintings. There is it is Orientalist, but it also has like a kind of realism to it.
Well, it feels more like like what an Orientalist photograph would be, where it still is like depictive of reality to some extent, you know, like it does seem to still be I don't know. Yeah.
So something that's interesting is that a lot of his paintings are of not of like of sultans or slave markets or war, at least like in that, like a lot of Russian war, but not necessarily a lot of war in regards to like these other places. Mm-hmm. What he's depicting is like life through the eyes of either common or poor people.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of these paintings are either of like of either like religious processions or of beggars or slaves. Like that is in stark contrast, like the French Orientalists.
Mm.
And that's why, in my opinion, I kind of hold that Vasari, he is an Orientalist, but he is not. It's not the same kind of Orientalism that you see in British Orientalism.
No, it's a lot more sympathetic. This one, though, I do see this is supposed to be a victory after a war, I assume, though, because we see heads on spikes.
Yes.
Lining up here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I can see that. All right. Yeah. Anyway. Oh, I guess I didn't describe this, but it looks like it's like a crowd surrounding these like heads on spikes in front of. Is it supposed to be a mosque?
I don't quite know. I don't know.
I guess it should be noted
that that when like this was exhibited in the West, this were like, oh my God, this is horrifying. So military officials, both like Russians and Germans, like feared that this would like affect like recruits in the military, and like demanded that this be pulled from public display. Like a friend of his, Gerald Kaufman, accused him of like, "You're falsifying history."
Falsifying.
it should be noted he never painted any portraits of any generals or any like military high officials.
Hmm.
It's almost always of like common soldiers, poor people, or average people.
Yeah.
So these are Orientalist paintings. I think Solomon's Wall less so.
Yeah, that one's the most human looking.
But I think even in that there is a humanity that he's trying to depict there.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a hell of a lot more than you could say for some other paintings that we're going to do now.
And let's move on to that one. The slave market presentation here.
By Otto Plitty.
This one is like textbook Orientalism in my mind.
Yep. So okay. Josiah, tell me what's going on in this painting. What's Otto trying to show us?
Oh, God. So we have two slave women being
what's the complexion, Josiah?
Oh, sorry. Two white women being presented by dastardly Arab-looking men in head coverings with their leers. And they're being presented to some men kind of relaxed on a carpet laid out in the middle of the desert. This is all out in the desert. It's very sandy looking. And the two men on the carpet have, of course, a hookah. So they're puffing at that good hookah stuff, which is, it's just another stereotype. There's no part of this painting that's not a stereotype. Holy shit. So yeah. And of course you have these innocent looking white skinned women appears to be auctioned off to these guys having a good time with the hookah. So
I don't think that I'm going to break your mind by saying that's not a slave market. That's not what a slave market.
No, that's not at all what a slave market looks like. I assume
slave markets did not in fact take place in the middle of the desert.
yeah. For another thing, I'm not sure if again, maybe this was a practice and I just wasn't aware of it, but like, I don't know. Have you ever smoked hookah before? It's a pain in the ass to keep the coals going. You wouldn't be doing this out in the middle of the desert, I'm pretty sure.
It appears that there's not even like a camp. Like, if it's a camp, there would be more of a setup here.
Yeah, and there's nothing to heat the coals to make the hookah happen. They just have this.
Do you think that shows that Otto did not know what a hookah was, really?
Yes. It does, yes. As someone who has smoked a lot of hookah in my day, I can say that is not how that looks.
No. Now, Otto is a Swiss painter. He specialized in Orientalist paintings, and almost all of his Orientalist paintings...
He hit it out of the park with this one, let me tell you.
Oh, man, I didn't even... There are dozens of examples that are, like... that are basically this. Like, All of them, for the most part, with some exception, relate to either like mystical long bearded Arab men leering at white skinned women, either dancing, or they're slaves, or they're being sold, or
there's a lot of fetishism going on. I just googled him on like Google Images, and looking through these, they're almost all set in the desert with those deserty kind of colors. The women are usually white. If you have one, looks like there's one depiction of kind of more of an Arabic looking woman on here. I don't know if this is by him or just, no, yeah, it but, is.
But we should note that woman is like, that's not a dress that someone in the desert's going to wear.
Well, I was going to say, because what I was going to point out is, yeah, she is seductively looking at the viewer holding, well, you know, with a horse.
There's a whole covering, feminist analysis she has that you can make of these,
single boob hanging out of her
dress. I think that's true. Like, it's fucking funny. Like, it's just singular.
This is pretty. What I hate is I quite like the colors though, and
it's pretty. The colors are pretty. It's
a really pretty painting, but it is
That's the issue that tends to be brought up. A lot of Orientalist paintings are pretty because they're colorful. They're it's not just sort of the drab colors that you get in like depicting Western Europe. There's good vivid colors and interesting compositions. And sometimes you get ones that have more of a complicated. You get ones like the Massacre at Chios, which has some more complicated history to it. Or you get something like Solomon's Wall, or where it's a bit more like there's some very obvious empathy here.
Yeah, right.
And interest in this as depicting like humans, like in a space. You don't have that here in the slave market presentation.
No, this is it's a pretty troubling depiction of the Arabic thing. So this is kind of interesting because there's this trend of like Arabic mistreatment of women quite a bit, which is, you know, still deep within the psyche of how people imagine the Middle East, which, to be fair, like when you talk about something, a place like Saudi Arabia is true in legislation. But, you know, you see this like happen where, in France, in the Mamenburg episode we recorded today, we talked about Marine Le Pen.
Right.
Fighting to make hijabs and head coverings illegal. And usually the argument comes from this like feminist kind of liberal almost thing of like, oh, it's an oppressive way of, even though most Arabic women don't see it that way, or most, I should say, Muslim women who choose to take on the hijab or whatever, don't see it that way. But there is like this obsession with the harem and the like sex slavery of the Middle East or whatever. In the kind of Orientalist imagination.
Which is not to say that, like, slave markets didn't exist. They did. And if you want to go read accounts of, like, what slave markets are like, they exist. They're well-detailed throughout the world. Mm-hmm. They're horrifying. There's a particular one that comes from where is this? This is from Daniel Walker, No More... No More, the University of Minnesota Press, sort of like particularly describing like an auction hall, selling some slave women. That's not this. They're horrifyingly depressing places where, it's depicting like human beings and women being completely dehumanized as just objects, which on one hand, yeah, this woman is an object, but then you have the analysis of the male gaze in this painting. The viewer is also objectifying these women.
Yeah. Cause that was kind of what I was thinking as I like looked up his paintings here is it's really odd. Cause on one hand, it's framing these women as like all victims of the, you know, this horrible, you know, slave market or whatever. But on the other hand, it is like, all of these are very sexual depictions of these women. Like which I think kind of fits from my understanding of like a lot of the Western imagination about the Middle East. It really does fit the, like, there's kind of this like disgust and attraction to the harem as a concept You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of a weird relationship it has with it. I don't know.
Yeah, there's the harem paintings are incredibly just awful. Like, they're like, and something, there's a few threads. I'll see if I could find them, then I'll send them to Josiah so that he can put them. There are some threads that were done on Twitter by West Asian artists talking about, like, how to depict, like, West Asian cultures in not an insulting manner. Mm-hmm. You don't do this. This is not how you, and also perhaps listen to like West Asian women about how to depict this. And also, if you're going to depict slavery, maybe depict it accurately and not this. There's so many problems with this with this painting. Like, so fucking many.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know exactly where one could start with just how. Like, I guess we kind of did, but there's just so much wrong in terms of the one, like the vilification of, like, if this was an actual slave market, these women would probably be like, would look pretty much like the dudes in terms of skin complexion.
Yes.
But you have, like, it's that fear, that exoticism of the foreign horde, at the gates of, that same bullshit, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one, I think, is very much the same theme as reflected in this other painting you sent me here, The Slave Market. It's
by kind of the Jean, same thing going Jean on. Jean Leon Garom. Yeah.
Yeah, Jerome here. Which is another painting of a very similar thing. This one's set indoors. One of the guys looks it's a little darker of skin complexion. It almost feels a little more like North African.
I haven't presented that, but you did have quite a few other paintings depicting more like North African people rather than I didn't select them because I forgot to. I probably should have, but there is quite a few there just that are depicting more like North and West African figures.
Yeah. So we see here this is indoors and it's looks like four men checking out this naked woman that they're looking at purchasing, and it looks like he's checking her teeth or something around those lines. It's again, she has the lightest skin tone among anybody else there, which is just kind of an odd thing.
And if you look in the background of the painting, there's more sort of inspections of like more like the if you think that guy is more North African, there's other individuals that have more of like darker skin features. There's in the background on the right, there's a bunch of them like doing the same thing to a black man.
Oh yeah.
And there's a black woman that's also I'm assuming that those are also slaves too on the ground.
Yeah. Well, okay, and it looks like her clothes are on the ground next to her, so it looks like they undressed her to decide if they want to purchase her. Again, and like as we've been saying, this is not how like slave markets would really
at all. And this is not even like how even harems would be depicted actually were either.
Mm-hmm.
So it presents like it's an unspecific, like this is just, it is an unspecific like Middle Eastern and or North African setting in which there are like various men inspecting the teeth of a nude white woman. We're depicted with like they're like there's a passive sexuality to them, while the men are depicted as domineering and disrespectful toward women. This should be noted that could also be seen that the male gaze again in this painting is prevalent.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, interesting. Okay, the other painting you had mentioned, I'll just throw it in here for both of us. Oh wait, it won't load. The one you had mentioned, that's the cover of Saeed's essay book. I didn't realize it's the same artist as this one here, Jerome. Yeah.
That was when I was doing an intro class on this. We talked about that painting for quite a bit. It's the Snake Charmer.
Yes.
Well, that's about. Would you like to describe that one?
Yeah. So we have a nude child. It looks like holding up a snake that's wrapped around their body. You have a man, very, very kind of stereotypical Indian almost, or, Eastern kind of man playing a flute. And then you have a crowd of, I'm having a hard time placing where this is supposed to be geographically, I guess.
That, you're going to find that a lot with quite a few, a lot of the more, well, all of these paintings are problematic in one way or another. Yeah. However, it's hard to exactly place, to place it geographically.
Yeah. You see, you can see all this Arabic on the walls, so I assume it's supposed to be, I guess
it's Islamic quite tribes, answer. Basically. Yeah, it's what the Islamic painting is. Yeah. Yeah, that's all that these people were, that the audience that these, that the painter was painting for, most likely the painter cared about.
No, yeah. Well, yeah, because that's what confuses me. Again, I'm not an expert in Asia by any means, but the guy playing the kind of flute thing, he looks like Indian to me. While then, like, yes, the people who are watching the Snake Charmer look, a lot of them look like sub-Saharan African, like very dark skin. Very, very confusing. Where this is supposed to be taking place.
Get ready for this. So Sarah Lees is a catalog essay, and a catalog essay for the painting examines like the conflation. So this is the Snake Charmer brings together widely disparate, even incompatible elements to create a scene that, as in the case with most of his oeuvre, the artist could not possibly have witnessed. Snake charming was not a part of Ottoman culture, but it was practiced in ancient Egypt and continued to appear in that country during the 19th century. Maxim Dukop, for example, described witnessing a snake charmer in Cairo during his 1849 to 51 trip with Gustave Flaubert, in terms that are comparable to Jerome's depiction, including mention of a young male disrobing in order to obviate charges of fraud. Because there's like an inherent risk in charming a venomous snake that can kill you if you have nothing protecting you.
Yeah.
The artist has placed this performance, however, in a hybrid fictional space that derives from identifiable Turkish as well as Egyptian sources.
Yeah,
as well as we can. So this goes even further. So the blue tiles are inspired by the Izni pottery in Western Anatolia, and in sort of like Ottoman era Constantinople. Some parts of the inscriptions, like, you can't really see them easily to be read. But there's stuff that's even from like a script that is Persian. There's Persian script there. There's some. That the fact
it's that not he's even the same languages. Yeah.
No, he's put like there's a mix of like Quranic verses and here that just don't make any sense. Like the verse that it has here is that there is no compulsion in religion. The right way is indeed clearly distinct from error. So whoever believes in the devil and believes in God, he indeed lays hold on the firmest handle which shall ever break. And God is hearing, knowing.
Weird. Okay.
It is. So the inscription thereafter, there's another inscription that probably has nothing to do with like a Quranic verse, but it's like a dedication to a particular caliph. The snake depicted might not even be like, it looks more like a South American boa constrictor than anything that could live in that region of the world.
Yeah. Well, and I'm kind of trying to figure out if the young boy with the snake is supposed to be depicted as kind of a victim in this case, because we see the same thing as you see in both of the slave market paintings, where he is probably the light. Yeah, he is definitely the lightest skinned person.
Yes.
There, forced to be naked in front of a crowd, which kind of fits the stuff that's going on in the other two paintings. I don't know. It's very odd.
There's a few other, I'll bring up some other quotes from, this is art critic Jonathan Jones. Mm-hmm. He is very blunt about, I think we could probably agree with this quote, a sleazy imperialist vision of the East. In front of glittering Islamic tiles that make the painting shimmer with blue and silver, a group of men sit on the ground watching a nude snake charmer draped with a slithering phallic python. The snake charmer is such an obviously pernicious and exploitative Western fantasy of the Orient that it makes Said's case for him, which is probably why Said chose this painting as the cover for as the cover for the essay.
Yeah, no, this, I was going to say, I'm glad that we decided to throw this one at the end, because this is quintessentially what Orientalism is. I kind of get that vibe from this.
he calls it, it's voyeurism. This is like, this is imperialist voyeurism. In The Snake Charmer, voyeurism is titillated, and yet the blame for this is shifted on the slumped audience in the painting. And this is my own addendum, not the painter, or the audience that this is sort of coming from. Meanwhile, the beautiful towns behind them are seen as survival of older and finer cultures, which, according to Edward Said, Western Orientalists claim to be to know and love better than the decadent locals did. That's also like the, like during the Islamic Golden Age, lot of like Greek texts were like saved.
We wouldn't have Aristotle today if it weren't for a lot of what the Greeks held on
that
to.
That is the kind of attitude that was present, that like we love this literature and philosophy more than they ever could.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Linda Nicolin, who was another, she's an American art historian, in her essay on the imaginary Orient, that like there's a photorealistic quality to all of like Jodorowsky's paintings, like, and there's an actual danger in what he's doing in like presenting a highly photorealistic rendering of a completely unrealistic scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as if it was an actual representation of what the East is.
Yeah.
The watchers are huddled against the ferociously detailed wall in the background of Jerome's paintings, are resoundingly alienated from us, as is the act they watch with such childish, trance-like concentration. Our gaze is meant to include both the spectacle and spectators as objects of picturesque delicatation. Clearly, these black and brown folk are mystified, but then again, so are we. Indeed, the defining mood of the painting is mystery, and it's created by a specific pictorial device. We are permitted only a beguiling rear view of the Snake Charmer, a full frontal basically, like, this is like there's the imagery that's presented here is highly, it's basically like a kind of imperialist voyeurism that is used to like depict a mythical, dangerous Orient that is both mystifying yet repulsive, that is both like alluring yet, and this is also nice, there are depictions of like more dark-skinned women, and that gets to like the idea of the Jezebel, the dangerous and dark-skinned woman that tempts the white man. That's why I put Vasali here, because I wanted him to be a contrast before we get to this really, really gross shit. I view like stuff, despite the fact that like that Jerome is objectively a good painter.
Mm-hmm.
This is disgusting what he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. No. Yeah, his stuff is a lot harder for me to appreciate.
Yeah. I think it's even I think that there's such a ridiculousness in Otto Pliny stuff that it's even a little easier to like appreciate it, because it's so just out there and ridiculous.
Yeah.
But Jerome's is significantly more photorealistic and a lot more, in my opinion, dangerous because of that, because it's depicting. It is trying to depict the East in a completely, like, in a way that is just, it is not. It is a fictional, like what we were saying. He's combining, like, these mishmashes into a completely, unrealistic setting, and is presenting it as if it's realistic.
Yeah. 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 No, that's really interesting, huh?
It should be also noted, he was not just an Orientalist painter, though that is, that is sort of like what he is most known for, is a lot of these Orientalist paintings. There's a whole lot of fun fact, in the that painting, The Slave Market, that he did, that one was used in the right-wing populist German party Alternative for Germany. That was used as their 2019 European Parliament election campaign. That was used as their campaign poster.
Oh, so that it does have some nefarious ties and its impact.
Definitely.
Psychedelic invocations, a matter, hurry at the station, I give to you. A job, a princess of Hindu birth, a woman of flesh, a child of the earth.
Well, I guess as we kind of move toward wrapping up a bit here, I would like to kind of tie this to, why does this discussion matter? You know what I mean? Because we're talking about a lot of these 20th century paintings, 19th, 20th yeah. century paintings. You know, but obviously this Orientalism is a really broad topic. You know, we see the birth of how the West imagines the East. And, you know, and it comes out when we talk about, well, when we talk about Middle Eastern politics, like Orientalism, if I'm correct, kind of had an academic renaissance as a concept during the War on Terror, because you started to see a lot of this same, you know, depictions of these like backwards kind of, places of chaos and Islamic, you know, extremism mixed with disregard for women and la di da di da when you as depicting Iraq or Afghanistan during the war. And that played into feeding the war efforts and allowing really horrible shit to take place. So it does matter, I guess, is what I'm saying here.
It does. I think the reason part of why I was bringing this up, on one hand, it's an interesting academic subject to sort of like delve into. And you can look at you delve with sort of like more morally complex subjects in paintings. Like we could have talked about like Jerome's like paintings of like historical subjects in Rome, but that I think that these are more complicated subjects mm-hmm. and still negative. I think Versali is probably the one who comes out of this looking the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's as far as I have gone through his career, he's never depicted the slave market.
Yeah.
And all of the women in his paintings have clothes. Which is something you cannot say for French Orientalists.
No.
There's, I think, like what you were saying, I think that this conversation matters because this still affects how the quote-unquote East and the quote-unquote Orient, like, it still affects like how that's sort of viewed today. The fact that that painting was used as a campaign poster for a far-right populist party in Germany, the fact mm-hmm. that this is, like, still presented in the minds of people in the West of this of like the dangerous men of the like Islamic men, the alien world of the East. It's mythical, it's dangerous, it's alluring, but it's also like it needs to be tamed and enlightened by the West. There's like older cultures there that we can appreciate more than the current inhabitants. They're filled with like swarthy, dangerous, dark skinned men who are like dangerous who practice a strange religion and are dangerous to the white women of the West. It is still something that you still find, like, this is still like rhetoric like this still affects like Islamophobic rhetoric that we still mm-hmm. see now.
Absolutely,
it's still affecting like the world now. And even what you brought up, like how this same kind of shit when it's talked about like Russians or Ukrainians or any people, if you like the Balkan Wars any kind of like the same kind of like othering, Orientalism mm-hmm. didn't invent it, but it is a great case study of how that is how that's like depicted and how it gets entrenched in the cultural milieu of a society, because we still have like this is still a thing, even if it's less sort of like out there like the slave market presentation,
right?
But even then, you probably would have people, if you find some people online or out there, they probably would think like, yeah, something like this is
how it looks.
Is how it looks when it's not. Like, is there slave markets? Yeah, they don't look like this.
Yes. Well, and I think there's kind of an interesting irony, because the very first painting we pointed to had the image of the heroic white guy kind of coming in and taming this chaotic region. And, you know, that's a really nefarious side of this stuff that has, you know, gone on to justify a lot of interventionist, campaigns in the Middle East and in Africa. And what's kind of an irony to that, just with all these images of slave markets, as comes to mind is like, well, when you think of most recent examples of the white guy coming in and taming it, I think of something like Libya. And NATO's invasion of Libya brought back the slave markets.
Right.
In this case, the heroic white guy showed up and it actually produced the thing that was supposedly kind of in subconsciously in the white imagination, the reason that you would even try to go help the people out in the first place, right? Get rid of this horrible culture. And yet actually it reproduced it. And oftentimes that's kind of the self-fulfilling cycle of like this image of the barbaric, it kind of, those images then actually get to kind of happen to those countries, but only because of intervention that happens there. You know what I mean? Like intervention will cause that chaos. And then you can point at the chaos and go, see, this is how uncivilized they are. As if, you know, a great power didn't come here and bomb the shit out of us, we wouldn't see monstrous things take place here as well, you know?
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think we'll probably sign off here. So do you want to just say where they can find you and all that? And
So I'll plug. So I did, I was on Fruitless this episode. You can watch this right now. If you're listening, hopefully this will, Josiah will be kind enough to invite me back again so we could talk about,
absolutely,
talk about more art history stuff. Cause I think this is, I think this stuff is interesting. I don't think you can really understand history without understanding the art that was produced during that time and how it relates socio politically and economically and, you know, yada yada and all that jazz. I also was on, Oddsplice to talk about slashers. So you could go give that episode a watch. You just watch Oddsplice because it's great.
It's a great podcast. Friend of the show, he, of course, Josh was the first guest on the show. So he's someone that I would highly respect, and you should listen to his stuff.
You should. We do a podcast together called Mammonberg.
Yeah, you might have heard of it.
You might have heard of it. If you're listening to Oddsplice, you probably either, if you know of Mammonberg.
Yeah. It's like this, but dumber.
Yeah, significantly. It's a lot dumber. If you're going to this thing, like, oh, there's some like deep discussions about like art and politics and culture and how they relate to one another, I'm gonna go give Mammonberg a listen. Don't expect that. That is not at all what we the episode that we recorded today involved our co-host doing a Waluigi voice talking about Marxism-Leninism and denying war crimes in Ukraine.
It's a real stupid show, let me tell you.
It's an incredibly stupid show. It is. I hesitate to recommend it, but
it's a fun time. So.
It is a fun time, so you can listen to that. I'm also on Twitter at Jackal Jester, where I should probably talk more about art history more.
You should.
If there's some, I might do that with some particular pieces because I do like talking about this stuff. But at the moment, I'm mostly talking about Disco Elysium and and like the video games and like what makes me mad. That's mostly what I'm doing. So I'm quote tweeting a lot of people and like talking about comic books and video games, and then I also did that post calling men who don't like muscly thighs cowards. So that if that's what you could expect from my Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening, and I will see you all next month.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.